Okay, so returning to our lecture on personality disorders, this being part two of the lecture, we are talking about Cluster B personality disorders. So we are now up to slide 23, histrionic personality disorder. This is a pervasive pattern of excessive emotionally and attention seeking, I'm sorry, of excessive emotionality and attention seeking, beginning by early adulthood and present in a variety of contexts, as indicated by five or more of the following, is uncomfortable in situations in which he or she is not the center of attention. Interaction with others is often characterized by inappropriate, sexually seductive, or provocative behavior. Displays rapidly shifting and shallow expression of emotions. Consistently uses physical appearance to draw attention to self. Has a style of speech that is excessively impressionistic and lacking in detail. Shows self-dramatization theatrically and exaggerated expression of motion, is suggestible, for example, easily influenced by others or circumstances, and considers relationships to be more intimate than they actually are. So essentially, this is a personality disorder that is characterized by extreme emotionality and attention-seeking behavior, and that the emotionality is more of an act than it being real. So in other words, in borderline personality disorder, that level of emotionality is real. That's what they're really experiencing. And a lot of times, because they are so emotional, people often will mistakenly think that a person with BTP is acting or doing it for manipulative purposes, and that's not the case. At least not that they're consciously aware of, right? But for histrionic personality disorder, they are doing it to try to manipulate. And the manipulation involves getting the attention on themselves. Causes for histrionic personality disorder? Well, there is a significant dearth, which means an extreme lack of research that exists. So we don't know much about this disorder in terms of the causes. According to cognitive behavioral therapy theory, these people would have a schema or general belief system that revolves around the thought, people need to cater to me. And that they have learned to get their needs met, probably from manipulating others with their attention-seeking behavior, such as when they were children, their parents, or maybe their siblings, or teachers, and so, like basic behavioral therapy theory, right? The more people kind of give in to this behavior, right, and reinforce this attention-seeking behavior, the more they're going to do it. And then that becomes more of a firmly ingrained personality or character. Treatment for histrionic personality disorder. Well, again, medication is only indirectly effective in regards to treating any other disorders or symptoms that they may have. For psychological interventions, cognitive behavioral therapy in particular, can be used to try to change this unhealthy schema and related thoughts that we talked about. And it can also highlight the cost-benefit analysis of their social behavior, similar to the technique for addictive disorders. In the short term, just like with addictive disorders, we try to teach the people that, while in the short term it provides some gratification, in the long term it provides all sorts of, bad consequences, Right. And so the bad consequences far outweigh any benefit or perceived benefit that they get. And we would do this in a very similar way for people with histrionic personality disorder. You know, the short-term benefit is getting attention, but what's a long-term benefit? People get fed up with them, and don't want to be around them. And so therefore, the very thing they want is that, you know, attention from other people they're eventually not going to get. Because people are going to learn to distance themselves from them. They're not going to get invited to the office parties. They're not going to, you know, they're going to be the people that people say, oh, there's so and so, you know, stay away from her. You know, I don't feel like dealing with her. They're going to be the ones talked about negatively at the office, you know, that kind of thing. In addition, teaching these people healthier social skills. So, all right. You want attention from others? Here's the right way to do it, right? Here's the appropriate way to do it. So, teaching them social skills where other people will give them attention, but for the right reasons. So, as children and adolescents, you can teach parents skills to resist reinforcing this attention-seeking behavior so that parents only reinforce appropriate social behavior or appropriate attention-seeking behavior. Not, you know, this kind of, you know, becoming emotional, or, trying to draw attention to themselves, unduly. You know what I'm saying? Okay. The last one in cluster B is narcissistic personality disorder. This is a pervasive pattern of grandiosity in fantasy or behavior, a need for admiration, and a lack of empathy beginning by early adulthood and present in a variety of contexts. Now, what's interesting here, you know, as we compare and contrast these different disorders, you'll notice that people with antisocial personality disorder lack empathy, right? And in fact, many people with antisocial personality disorder also have narcissistic personality disorder. But when we're talking about this lack of empathy in narcissistic personality disorder, it's a little different from antisocial personality disorder. In antisocial personality disorder, they lack empathy. Because they just have not ever learned to care about other people. They you know, they just never had real close relationships beginning as a child, and they've never really learned to care about people on any kind of deep level, right? In narcissistic personality disorder, they're so consumed by themselves that when you're so consumed by yourself and your needs, you're self-absorbed, right? Then it's going to be very difficult to care about somebody else. When you're so over-focused on yourself, it's hard to put yourself in another person's shoes, so to speak, or take their perspective, which is fundamental to acquiring empathy, okay? And so, symptoms of narcissistic personality disorder, they often have a grandiose sense of self-importance. They exaggerate their achievements and talents. They expect to be recognized as superior without commensurate achievements. They're preoccupied with fantasies of unlimited success, power, brilliance, beauty, or ideal love. They believe that he or she is special and unique and can only be understood by or should associate with other special or high status people. They require excessive admiration. They have a sense of entitlement, unreasonable expectations of especially favorable treatment or autonomic compliance with his or her expectations. I think that's supposed to be automatic. Automatic compliance with his or her expectations. They often are interpersonally exploitative, which means taking advantage of others to achieve his or her own needs, right? My needs are more important than yours. They lack empathy is or are unwilling to recognize or identify with the feelings and needs of others. They are often envious of others or believe that others are envious of him or her. And they show arrogant, haughty behaviors or attitudes. Now, this is really what most of us psychologists think of as an elaborate defense mechanism for underlying feelings of inadequacy or inferiority. And so, with that being said, we'll talk about more specifically the theorized causes of this disorder. Again, there's a dearth of research that exists for this disorder in terms of any biological factors. Okay. According to cognitive behavioral therapy theory, these people have a schema or general belief system that revolves around the thought, I am special and need to be admired. But, this is a very fragile kind of schema. So in essence, you can almost think of their schema as having a question mark at the end, right? Like, I am special and need to be admired. So this schema is more of like, their ideal. This is what they would really like to truly, truly believe. And on the surface is what they seem to believe, but deep down inside, there's a real questioning, like, but maybe I'm not all that special, or what if I'm not, right? So that if you criticize them, or if you're a person that makes them feel insecure because, you're a hot shot, you really have a lot going for yourself, then it doesn't take much for this belief system to kind of fall apart within a second, at the slightest bit of criticism or any evidence to say that they're not so great. So how does that develop? Well, it's suspected that early childhood experiences contribute, in which the child never learns empathy or a desire to fulfill others' needs due to failure by the parents to model these values. So that the parents are not valuing empathy, they don't model empathy because they're not, engaging in that kind of behavior, or they're not, kind of teaching the child these kinds of values. And think about it, if a parent is not very empathic or doesn't really think it's so important to fulfill others' needs, what kind of parent are they going to be? Well, they're not going to be a very good parent, right? Because they're not going to fulfill the child's needs or give them a lot of empathy. And so that's why they have this real kind of fragile ego, even though, or fragile self-esteem or sense of self, even though they seem by outward presentation to, think the world of themselves. So, how do we treat this disorder? Well, again, medication is only effective for treating any other disorders or symptoms they may have, which frequently is depression, especially if, they start having, start seeing a lot of evidence to counter their belief that they're so special. And then cognitive behavioral therapy can challenge this unhealthy schema that they have. And also, because we suspect that they have a real fragile ego and they really do lack confidence or, a good, stable sense of self-esteem, essentially we're trying to build that up in them and to have a healthier sense of self-esteem, that they're important and special as everybody is important and special because for the very reason that there's no two people alike in this world, right? That you are a unique individual. And so, yeah, you're special in that way, but no more special in the sense that everybody is special and everybody is entitled to be treated fairly and have their needs fulfilled and everything else. And so that's the ultimate goal. And we can work towards that goal by helping to desensitize them to criticism, that, these people tend to be hypersensitive to this kind of criticism because it counters their view of specialness. So to teach them cognitive techniques so that they're not so concerned with others' views of them. And that basically we're trying to get this person to be more secure with themselves. When I think of a secure person, I don't think of a perfect person. I don't think of a person who does everything right. What I think of as a secure person is a person that is fully accepting of themselves, their good points, their bad points, their qualities, their flaws, and they're okay with that. Also, with that being said, not only are they very okay with who they are as a person and they feel very secure, but also are very attuned to other people's needs. And that kind of flows together, right? Like, if you feel good about yourself, then you'll feel more inclined to help others and do things for them. If you don't feel good about yourself, then you can be very self-absorbed. I mean, even people with depression can be very self-absorbed, right? Even though they don't think very highly of themselves often, they have very low self-esteem usually, they're self-absorbed in the sense that they're consumed by their misery and, all these bad thoughts they have about themselves. So if you're not in a good place, you're going to be over-focused on yourself and you're not going to be able to be focused on other people. That's essentially what we're talking about. So we're trying to help these people become more secure with themselves, to accept themselves for who they really are and be okay with that, that they don't need to be this, amazing person in every context or aspect of life. And then also more direct teaching of skills such as empathic listening so that they can connect with other people. These people lose friends, the relationships don't last for them. In fact, I would say with all the personality disorders, all of these personality disorders, that is the biggest impairment is social relationships, that many of these people have a real hard time connecting with people or keeping or maintaining relationships, friendships or romantic relationships, etc. And then finally, teaching them some relaxation techniques, since they do tend to get real frazzled when people criticize them or don't think so highly of them, we don't want them to act out in anger and, really make situations worse. So they need to learn relaxation skills to be able to kind of, be more, for lack of a better way of saying it. Okay. Now we're going to go on to the Cluster C personality disorders. So the first one here is avoidant personality disorder. This is a pervasive pattern of social inhibition, feelings of inadequacy, and hypersensitivity to negative evaluation, beginning by early adulthood and present in a variety of contexts, as indicated by four or more of the following. So, for those of you who are jumping to the conclusion, saying like, "Wow, that sounds a lot like social anxiety disorder," good for you, right on. A lot of people believe that if social anxiety disorder is not treated early on, in terms of, as a child or adolescent, that can eventually become a more firmly ingrained personality disorder such as this one. Okay? In fact, a lot of these kinds of disorders that we've talked about that, seem to be a condition unto themselves can turn into a personality disorder just because the more that you have these kinds of symptoms, the more they kind of become part of your identity and become more ingrained in terms of who you are. So, you might see in the next version of the DSM, depressive personality disorder. For people that, depression just becomes, or these negative thoughts and all these symptoms just becomes a part of who they are. It no longer is a condition that they've acquired. It becomes who they are, I don't know if you guys remember Saturday Night Live skits with Debbie Downer, right? So Debbie Downer would be like somebody with maybe a depressive personality disorder, just always down and pessimistic about things. So essentially, a lot of these different disorders we've talked about can become so ingrained in the person's identity that they can become a personality disorder. And for avoidant personality disorder, social anxiety disorder can become avoidant personality disorder. Okay? It doesn't have to, though, but it can be. This type of person has symptoms such as avoiding occupational activities that involve significant interpersonal contact. So they may go into job fields such as being an engineer, where you don't have to be in as much direct contact with people. And the reason why they are avoiding these kinds of occupations is because of fears of criticism, disapproval, or rejection, just like with social anxiety disorder. They are often unwilling to get involved with people unless certain of being liked, so they don't take social risks. They show restraint within intimate relationships because of the fear of being shamed or ridiculed. They are preoccupied with being criticized or rejected in social situations. They are inhibited in new interpersonal situations because of feelings of inadequacy or fears of rejection. They view themselves as socially inept, personally unappealing, or inferior to others, so they have a very low level of self-esteem. And they are unusually reluctant to take personal risks or engage in any new activities because they may prove embarrassing. So their whole life is governed by this fear of being rejected by people, okay? And if you're thinking, could this kind of disorder also present with agoraphobia, where they don't want to leave the house? Absolutely, and good critical thinking skills. So there is limited research that exists for this disorder, and it's possible because these people are reluctant to seek out treatment because they're probably fearful of being evaluated negatively by the therapist. So, because they don't seek out treatment often, there's not a lot of research on this disorder. There is some biological evidence of a genetic predisposition, but more generally for schizophrenia-like disorders, so for all those kinds of disorders that involve social withdrawal: schizoid personality disorder, schizotypal personality disorder, schizophrenia, all those kinds of disorders. According to cognitive behavioral therapy theory, these people have a schema, a general belief system that revolves around the thought, people will reject me if they get to know me. So therefore, they avoid people. It is suspected that early childhood experiences may contribute to the development of this disorder, such as parental rejection, lack of affection, and neglect. And of course, if a child is feeling rejected by their parents, or their parents are not giving them affection, or they're neglecting them, then the child will, of course, just withdraw from their family and people altogether. And thus starts the pattern, right? How do we treat this disorder? Medication, again, only useful for treating other disorders or symptoms they might have, particularly the anxiety. But psychological interventions, which are going to be able to be used on the long term, because as it is a personality disorder, they're going to require a long-term intensive therapy. Cognitive behavioral therapy can potentially be helpful in terms of challenging the unhealthy schema and related thoughts that we talked about, especially those related to social rejection, in conjunction with exposure-based techniques and social homework. The same kinds of techniques that we would use in what? That's right, social anxiety disorder. So we could challenge their belief that being rejected is horrible by giving them experiment of, dressing eccentrically or, trying to actually get people to reject them so that they can realize that this is not such a horrible experience or as bad as they thought it would be, okay? I told you Albert Ellis, who is the founder of Rational Motor Behavior Therapy, used to do this experiment where he would go to the park and ask out 100 girls, right? And so, and he wasn't a terribly attractive guy. So, asking out 100 different women, right? And of course, that is going to entail being rejected a lot of times, right? Most of the times he was rejected. And that, he just kind of became desensitized to the rejection because he was so used to it after a while. After, I think he said, like, after the 10th rejection, he just didn't care nearly as much anymore. So we can give those kinds of exposure-based assignments or other kinds of social homework. Could be not so drastic, like, okay, you always think you're going to be rejected. Well, just like in that experiment that Albert Ellis used to do with himself, guess what? A lot of women rejected him, but guess what? There were a bunch that didn't, that actually accepted. And so we can also teach them to put themselves out there more and take social risks to really challenge that idea. Am I always going to be rejected? And, lo and behold, many times they're going to find out that people are not so mean, people are not so rejecting, and that people are willing to engage in conversation with them or become an acquaintance or a friend or maybe even a lover, okay? And then, more direct training of social skills, because a lot of them have social skill deficits. Again, because that old adage, right? If you don't use it, you lose it. Okay, I believe this is the 9th personality disorder out of 10. We are now up to dependent personality disorder. This is a pervasive and excessive need to be taken care of that leads to submissive and clinging behavior and fears of separation, beginning by early adulthood and present in a variety of contexts, as indicated by 5 or more of the following. Has difficulty making everyday decisions without an extensive amount of advice and reassurance from others. Needs others to assume responsibility for most major areas of his or her life, right? They're dependent on them. Has difficulty expressing disagreement with others because of fear of loss of support or approval. Has difficulty initiating projects or doing things on his or her own because of a lack of self-confidence in judgment or abilities rather than a lack of motivation or energy. Goes to excessive lengths to obtain nurturance and support from others to the point of volunteering to do things that are unpleasant. Feels uncomfortable or helpless when alone because of exaggerated fears of being unable to care for himself or herself. Urgently seeks another relationship as a source of care and support when a close relationship ends. Is unrealistically preoccupied with fears of being left to take care of himself or herself. So, similar to avoidant personality disorder, these people also fear being rejected, okay? But they react very differently, and they also have a more general lack of confidence, So they have a more general lack of confidence than people with avoidant personality disorder, where they're just unconfident with not only their social ability, but just their ability to do things in general, okay? To take care of themselves in general. And they deal with their fear of rejection differently. Rather than avoiding people, they cling to people. And basically they're extra deferring to people. They're subservient to people. I'll do anything for you. Whatever you need, I'm there for you. Hey, guess what? I was at Target and I thought of you today, so I bought you this, this, and that. Or, oh, let me go and give you some money here because it seems like you're having a hard time. Or, how about I do this for you? How about I do that for you? Basically, they will be completely subservient to people in hopes that these people will not leave them or abandon them. Now, we also see this clingy behavior in people with borderline personality disorder, but the difference is when people reject or they think they're being rejected in borderline personality disorder, those people with BPD react very, with a lot of volatility, and can act out towards them, where people with dependent personality disorder, will not often act out against people if they're rejected. What they'll do is overcompensate and think, oh boy, that person doesn't like me. I have to do even more for them to get them to like me. So that would be the difference with those disorders. Causes. There is biological evidence of a genetic predisposition, which would make sense because there's evidence of a genetic predisposition for social anxiety disorder and all anxiety disorders. According to cognitive behavioral therapy theory, these people have a schema or general belief system that revolves around the thought, I need to rely on people for my survival, for my self-preservation. I can't do things on my own. I need people. And also, I can't stand to be rejected would probably be a second closely related thought or schema. It is suspected that early childhood experiences may contribute that involve, again, parental rejection or even abandonment, and maybe like extreme abandonment in the case of a parent dying when they were a child at an early age. So, like borderline personality disorder, they have fears of abandonment as well, but they react very differently. How do we treat this? Medication, again, only effective for any associated symptoms or disorders. Psychological interventions. Cognitive behavioral therapy, again, challenging the unhealthy schema and related thoughts, especially those related to social rejection, inadequacy, and a perceived need for reassurance. And also, I would add, challenging thoughts that are related to them not having confidence, like trying to challenge those thoughts in the sense that you don't need people for everything. There are plenty of things you can do. So essentially, the patient needs to understand how their clingy behavior is not necessary. And it's to keep other people in your life. It's not necessary. And that it will actually often elicit rejection. So the one thing that they fear, this behavior will actually increase the probability of it happening, right? If you could imagine having a friend who's excessively clingy, or a person in your life who's like that, maybe it's a fellow classmate you've met this year, that can be a big turnoff for most of us. What's sometimes interesting to think about, I'm just going to go off on a brief tangent here, but the personality disorders is how some of them can work together. In the sense of, if you're thinking of like romantic relationships, right? Like, who would dependent personality disorder fit really well with, right? Narcissistic personality disorder, right? So just think about that. It's very interesting, but you can have two people who have these pretty severe pathological conditions, but yet their relationship actually function quite well. So two negatives can equal a positive. But it's interesting, right? Like a narcissist would probably work out very well with a dependent personality disorder. The dependent personality disorder would be very clingy on them, and the narcissist would love it. Be like, yeah, you think the world of me, you'll do anything for me. Well, you should because I'm special. I feel like all people should do this. Of course, I deserve all this great treatment. Okay, so what else could we do with cognitive behavioral therapy? Well, again, we could also teach them more appropriate social skills. and address any related deficits and teach them independent problem-solving skills and just independent skills so that they don't feel like they need to rely on other people as well. And you know, again, through different kinds of homework exercises, really challenging this idea that they need people. Do you really need people to do to create a food list? Let's see you do it on your own. Let's challenge that belief. I bet you can. You know, something of that nature. Okay, the last one, obsessive compulsive personality disorder. This is similar to obsessive compulsive disorder. And again, could a obsessive compulsive disorder turn into obsessive compulsive personality disorder? It can. Can a person have obsessive compulsive disorder and obsessive compulsive personality disorder? They can. If you have obsessive compulsive disorder, do you have to have obsessive compulsive personality disorder? No. If you have obsessive compulsive personality disorder, also you don't necessarily have to have obsessive compulsive disorder. Did I confuse you? I hope not. Okay, so obsessive compulsive personality disorder is a pervasive pattern of preoccupation with orderliness, perfectionism, and mental and interpersonal control at the expense of flexibility, openness, and efficiency, beginning by early adulthood and present in a variety of contexts, as indicated by four or more of the following. Is preoccupied with details, rules, lists, order, organization, or schedules to the extent that the major point of the activity is lost. Shows perfectionism that interferes with task completion, is unable to complete a project because of his or her own overly strict standards that are not met. Is excessively devoted to work and productivity to the exclusion of leisure activities and friendships, not accounted for by obvious economic necessity, is overconscientious, scrupulous, and inflexible about matters of morality, ethics, or values, not accounted for by cultural or religious identification, is unable to discard worn-out or worthless objects even when they have no sentimental value, is reluctant to delegate tasks or to work with others unless they submit to exactly his or her way of doing things, adopts a miserly spending style toward both self and others, money is viewed as something to be hoarded for future catastrophes, and they are rigid and stubborn. Sound like a fun person to have a relationship with? You bet. Sarcasm intended. You know, a lot of lay people throw around this term like, oh my God, this person's so OCD or that person's so obsessive compulsive. What they really are referring to when you know people lay people are calling other people OCD, you know, we saw when we were going over obsessive compulsive disorder, we saw that TED talk on that girl who had it, who had obsessive compulsive disorder, who was, you know, pretty upset by, you know, how this term is thrown around you know, by people on social media. When really it's not a laughable kind of condition, it's something very serious. But you know, those terms that are thrown around so cavalierly by people, really, those terms that are thrown around so cavalierly by people, really are referring to obsessive compulsive personality disorder, not obsessive compulsive disorder. It's more of a personality style. That they're talking about when they are saying somebody is OCD. Okay, so they're really OCPD. These people tend to be very ambitious and real go-getters. And but yet, as ambitious and much of a go-getter as they are, they may not get very far in life because a lot of people at work don't want to deal with them because they can be very domineering in terms of, you know, it's my way or the highway, you know, this is the right way to do it, this is the way you're supposed to do it, follow my lead. And so, you know, we know in order to have occupational success, not only, you know, do you need to be competent and capable, but you also have to have good social skills, right? And be able to work with people. And so this disorder can interfere with that. There is some biological evidence of a genetic predisposition for this disorder, but it may be more for the general trait of just having a strong need for structure or perfectionism. Also, parents are suspected to reinforce this need, so that a lot of parents, seem to value this, perfectionistic trait, this achievement-oriented trait, and even parents that don't have obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, you could see inadvertently reinforcing it. I mean, what parent is not going to be proud of their kid who comes home with straight A's? Or who studies endlessly, right? Or who practices their musical instrument for hours and hours and hours and, achieves these great things, So parents often inadvertently reinforce this disorder by, praising the child and saying what a great job they're doing. But meanwhile, what they're doing is they're reinforcing this disorder, which is not good because it's unhealthy. It's unhealthy to be so perfectionistic. And it interferes with other areas of one's life. Okay? According to cognitive behavioral therapy theory, these people have a schema or general belief system that revolves around the thought, I need to always do my best and be perfect. So can you kind of see the difference between obsessive compulsive disorder that has to do with these obsessions and then these compulsions to neutralize these obsessions, and then this more personality style that's just very fixated on, being perfect and orderly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, certainly one can have obsessive compulsive disorder that revolves around that theme of orderliness, right? But that, tends to be, much more intense or dramatic. In terms of and involve like a lot of nonsensical rituals, whereas this is just like a personality style that leads to excessive behaviors to try to do things perfectly and to always achieve the utmost level of success. Treatments for this disorder. Medical treatments, again, only effective in regards to treating other associated disorders or symptoms. They often do have anxiety because when you're always insisting that things be perfect and things often are not perfect, you're going to have a lot of anxiety about that. So, certainly, medication for anxiety. Cognitive behavioral therapy can be helpful to challenge the unhealthy schema and related thoughts that we talked about, especially those related to perfectionism and the perceived need for orderliness. And so we can challenge that schema with the cognitive techniques that you know about, and we can also challenge it by behavioral techniques such as response prevention, like they need to have all the items in their desk be a certain way. Well, let's mess up their desk and have them be okay with that. Have them just deal with that anxiety of having a messy desk. Or maybe they need to experience getting a B on a test. And that real, and so that they can learn that that's not the end of the world. Or they need to not, they need to experience not doing things perfectly and to learn to be okay with that. Okay? And certainly other exposure-based techniques. The example I put here is, let's say you have a patient that feels that they need to devote 8 hours for a work task that clearly you have deduced would never need to be that long. At most, half of that amount of time would be more than sufficient to do that task exceptionally well. And so, their fear is if I don't do it for 8 hours, then it won't come out great. Well, how about they only devote 4 hours to it and then see what actually happens? And lo and behold, maybe they'll see that, hey, I only spent 4 hours on the task and it still came out great. So that's how we can directly challenge those kind of schemas. And then also relaxation skills can be important to help reduce anxiousness and help them relax. ACT techniques are those specific techniques we talked about briefly, particularly way back when, towards the beginning of the course. Acceptance and commitment therapy techniques, ACT techniques. These are basically techniques where we teach a person not to do anything about their thoughts. Because, sometimes these thoughts, these intrusive kind of thoughts that they need to be a certain way and they need to act a certain way, sometimes the best way to deal with them is to not deal with them, to just kind of be with them. To just kind of accept that I'm gonna have these irrational thoughts that are gonna talk to me and tell me, this needs to be perfect. I need to do this way. This needs to be perfectly organized. This needs to be orderly. It's gotta be exactly in this way. Sometimes you need to be taught to not react to those thoughts, to just let them be, almost like meditation, just letting them be, letting them pass over you. And so if you remember, ACT is a set of what we call mindfulness-based techniques. So sometimes it's appropriate to directly challenge the beliefs, and then other times it's appropriate to teach these people to let them go. There are times to challenge them and times where you can't do anything about them, and you just need to sit with them and let them pass over you. Okay? Okay. So that concludes our lecture on personality disorders. And what was I going to say? We have one more lecture left. I can't believe it. I have been cranking through these lectures. If you haven't already noticed, I know you're probably getting emails like every day, a new set of lectures is available, a new set of lectures available. The test is not going to be until May 11th. So I don't expect you to have, listened to or completed all these lectures, in the next couple weeks. You have plenty of time to complete these lectures. So take your time with them. We have one more lecture left, and it's not going to be heavy content. It's going to be more on talking about ethics related to psychotherapy and general considerations related to psychotherapy. And most of it is going to entail a video. With one of your professors, not me, but I should say one of the professors in the psychology department of St. John's that actually conducted a live therapy session in front of an audience. And so that will be interesting to see so that you can get a taste of what does therapy actually look like, particularly cognitive behavioral therapy. Okay, until then, please stay well and stay safe.